This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to Podcast Deluxe, your safe full of USBs. Don't worry, we have the receipts of Weekly Cultural Review. I'm John Caramonica, critic of the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I'm a reporter at the New York Times.
We'll never tell what's in our safes full of USBs. It's
actually a safe right over there.
And I shudder to think of what's in there. We are going to talk about Drake this week as if there were another topic.
Yeah.
There couldn't possibly be another topic. Certainly for the last 3 days since the album came out and for the weeks prior.
Months. We saw Drake months ago.
It's been a long summer.
Yeah.
It's been a long summer. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the album, For All the Dogs. There's a lot going on in Drake land. And I think maybe most crucially, there's a lot going on in the land of people who have things to say about Drake.
People are sick of Drake.
Also, just like, if Drake did not put out an album on Friday, we would still be at peak Drake discourse.
Yeah.
It has so little to do with the quality, depth, originality, thoughtfulness, utility of this record. It has so much to do with everything else. But we'll get into all that.
It gives people a place to put their...
Yeah, it's proxy.
Energies, their frustrations. Their frustrations both with Drake and with themselves, man. And with the world, certainly.
A lot of y'all are frustrated with yourselves. I mean, we regret to inform you. A lot of y'all are frustrated with yourselves.
It's a lot to deal with.
It's a lot, even just as a third party. It's a lot to absorb.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to get into all that. And then we're going to do maybe a little bit of a reality television primer.
Just a quick catch up.
Yeah. Like there's
TV is back. The writer's strike is over, but it doesn't matter because reality TV is back.
Reality TV is back. Here's the thing. I'm very grateful the writer's strike was resolved. We want nothing more than fair and equitable pay for writers. That's important. That said, I'm very happy with a steady diet of reality television. Yeah,
you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, like literally, truthfully. All right. For All the Dogs.
Ruff, ruff.
Woof. It's nice to hear a woof on an album every now and again.
Yeah, those are strong dog barks really, on Bahama Promises.
Where is the soundboard? Like, is that, dun, 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 dun. Is there like a... Like, is there like a website where are they like free? Are they free use? Fair use? Whoops.
They have Shazam for dog barks.
Like for different breeds?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. This album is fine. Let's just get it right out of the way. The album is fine. But I sort of stand by what I said a minute ago, which is in the overall arc of the last like 3 to 4 months of Drake discourse, I would say that this album in its the fact of it and the specifics of it is the least important part of the Drake discourse.
Of everything that Drake has done basically in 2023?
It's not that it's less important than the book or the tour. It's that the discourse is so hyperventilating at this point. It doesn't at all reflect the quality, the importance of the record. It's not connected to this could have been the best album of Drake's career. I think it would have hit equally the same. To me, it's not the best album in Drake's career, not by a long shot, but I don't think that the quality of the record has any correlation to the intensity of the conversation.
And the tenor of the response.
I think they're totally disaggregated at this point. And we were talking about this a tiny bit earlier. And I think part of that is when you're talking about Drake, and by you, I mean people on the internet. And that could be like professional commentators. It could be random people who are fans or not fans. When we used to fight about Drake
back in the day.
Excuse me, son. When we used to fight about Drake in the late 2000s and the early 2010s, boy, I tell you, fights were different. You were fighting about form. You're fighting about the way that a rapper, quote unquote, should be. Should a rapper sing? Should a rapper be vulnerable? Should a rapper be a child actor from Canada? Like, all of those things yeah. were the nature of the debate.
Yeah.
And for a certain period of time,
that was up for debate.
Even if it really wasn't up for debate, it was up for debate. And you could plausibly have, I want to say, reasonable disagreements with people who had different perspectives on where Drake fit in the lineage. It was interesting. There's like a sort of very, very side, thin slice of discourse that's like going back to the very first Drake mixtape. I was like, well, no, Drake used to be a real lyricist.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just like, I
Drake
remember
used to be a backpacker on room for
also, it's like, I remember where y'all were in 07 and 08. You were not arguing for pro backpack Drake. Like, yep. I just wanna,
nobody likes that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I just want to be extremely clear that if in this moment you're like trying to say like the old Drake,
I miss room for improvement, Drake.
Yeah. Like, if you're just like, I'm gonna have a values based argument for Drake, like, y'all were not kicking that in 07 and 08. Yeah. That is not real. Mm-hmm. But you can have those fights about form and you can have those fights about content, quote unquote, loosely construed. And maybe those are reasonable disagreements to have. But how many years of disagreements can you possibly have about that? Apparently, you can have them for like 10 years.
Sure.
Like, I remember when I did the thing at the end of the 2010s about how like K-pop is like basically just Drake now and mm-hmm. reggaeton is just Drake. And people were just
was
like,
not received well.
No, people were just mad. I mean, the tweet was like a little, I you know, a little bit of an aggy tweet. But like, people were just like, how dare you, you know, how dare you, TJ Swan? Like, how dare you not honor that? I know about TJ Swan. Like, stop. But like, you know, it's just one of those things where people were still arguing. And I guess I always thought those arguments were empty, but at least they were rooted in some kind of read on the genre. Like, you could maybe argue that, hey, people shouldn't be saying this. Like, I don't agree with it. It seems close-minded. It seems short-sighted. It seems, frankly, ahistorical when you think about the role of melody in the genre dating back to the 70s and 80s. But it gave it was a thing that people felt you could take a side on. You can't do that anymore, because if you're mad at Drake's formal innovations, if you're mad at Drake's formal skill set, you're implicitly mad at basically everybody else who's not on Griselda.
Yeah, you just don't like popular music.
Right. You don't like rap music. You don't like contemporary rap. And so most of those people have been sort of like washed out of the paint. And now you're left with people who accept Drake on principle, but are finding other things to be frustrated by.
And now it seems to be the tone of the response, which, again, the response is bad. Like, just to use, you can catch it in the vibes, but just to use something close to concrete, Metacritic has this album at a 47.
Oh, wow.
Which puts it as like the worst rap album of the decade or something, you sure. know, like as if it's like, you know, Metallica and Lou Reed, or, you know, as if it's like you're saying, like, as if it's something that's completely.
Don't send us emails about the Metallica Lou Reed album.
You know what I mean, though? Like, as if he decided to make like experimental black metal or something, like, and not just a
Steve
bunch.
Harvey fronting a hardcore.
Yeah. And not just like a bunch more Drake songs.
Yeah.
But the tenor of the response is now so personal. And the overarching question seems to be, how bad a person is Drake? Like, it's not just enough to say, like, these songs bore me, or we've heard this before from Drake, or the contemporary sounds that he's jumping on, like, it's too incongruous because now he's X years old and it's weird for him to try to sound like Yeet or whatever.
Are you older than Drake?
No. How dare you?
I'm just wondering.
I'm not like gaining and passing him. Like,
no. I just forgot where you were.
Like, no. Drake and LeBron are the same age, and they'll always be a couple years older than me.
Okay. So you're allowed to like the things that Drake likes because you're a couple years younger.
Although we're at very different stations in life. given what he's upset about on this album, especially romantically.
Yeah.
The only way I can put it is that I feel like people have Drake derangement syndrome.
Yeah.
And like, they just like, there's so much animosity towards his inevitability in culture, I think, that now people are parsing what he says as, it's more like he's a politician than it is he's a rapper. And you alluded to this in your review, like he's like a dictator almost, and people just can't get rid of him as this omnipresence.
That is
and it's like people will find any little, any line that's like, for instance, the Esperanza Spalding line. Can we just zoom in on that one for a minute?
We certainly can.
This is on Away From Home.
Away From Home functions like the last song on a lot of Drake albums. It's not the last song, but it sort of functions that way. It's kind of memoiristic.
A lot of names.
A lot of very, very specific people who, like, if you're up on the Drake mythology, you may know a lot of those people or may be clued into who they are. But
he's written a lot of songs like this.
And they always, to me, they always really serve, even after his most like bombastic albums, they really serve to ground him and be like, this is like a guy living a very specific story. And he's privileging that story sometimes at the price of a hit.
Yes.
He wants, this is part of the narrative.
Yes.
It's important. So let's listen to the Esperanza Spalding bars.
Yeah.
On
Away From Home.
4 Grammys to my name, 100 nominations. Esperanza Spalding was getting all the praises. I'm trying to keep it humble. I'm trying to keep it gracious.
I want to hear what you have to say. But yeah. I do want to, the first thing I want to say is Esperanza Spalding. I'd love to post a photo of Esperanza Spalding holding her Grammy for Best New Artist, which was won in
2011.
The Grammy for Best New Artist goes to Esperanza Spalding.
It is 12 years ago.
Yep. Beating Justin Bieber along with Drake.
Plausible to beat Bieber. Why is Drake talking about this in 2023?
Okay. The hook of this song is, I remember, basically, right? He's putting you in his mindset when he's in these various stations of trying to make it. He's failing a lot in this song. It's a song of frustration memorized.
Yeah, it's about obstacles.
Yes. Everyone is very offended, if I'm to believe my timeline, that he would invoke the name of
Esperanza,
a jazz singer. He was mad when he lost Best New Artist in 2011. The song is transporting you back to him being mad. And I'm just like, what are we actually upset about? Like, not to tip or gore this, but like, you should hear some of the rap songs I listen to. if this is the pearl clutching moment for people, like as if this is like, this is the silver bullet to prove that Drake is the biggest misogynist on the planet.
Yes.
I just like, are we sure that we can't just listen to songs and they can be funny, they can be mean, they can be acidic, they can be horrible even, but it's okay because they're music about a time and a place and a feeling, like just like what, like it's okay, like she's gonna be all right, guys, like she's gonna be okay.
You think she's coming back with bars?
Either way, she should feel more than open to coming back at Drake however she wants. She can make fun of him in any medium and it would be fine and it would be deserved on his part,
and also, like, it would probably be funny as well.
Yeah, and like this happened to him, he's allowed to rap about it.
Okay. So do you think that the people who are pointing to this as one of a handful of examples of misogynistic tendencies on the album, let's not talk about real life, because like we don't know.
That's what the main thing is. We don't know this person. We don't know these people. Drake is rich and alone and bitter. Like that's the Drake character. And that has been the Drake character for many years. I mean, this is villain Drake, I would say, for the last, since Certified Lover Boy, since he put out the album cover with the pregnant emoji. That's like peak villain Drake.
To keep it real, I wasn't really gangster till now. I was living on a cloud.
I was quiet as a mouse. Do you see the genius annotation? Is Drake the type of guy to say quiet as a mouse? Well, that one's really good. I mean, he literally plays the Scarface say goodnight to the bad guy monologue on this album.
I know.
Like, how much more, like, that's so on the nose. Like, and this is a version of Drake that he's giving us, maybe because he doesn't have another version to give us at the moment. But look, like, if he wants to rap bitterly about Esperanza Spalding, okay. If he wants to rap bitterly about Rihanna, okay. Like, what? Like, it's not personal, and it's not moral.
I might be personal. I don't know.
It's not personal to the listener.
Okay. I will say one thing that jumped out at me a couple times on this record, and I did talk about in the review, is there is a Drake tendency to go for the groaner.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of groaners on this record. And that has always been a Drake tendency. And I feel like, I don't want to misquote a thing he said to me, but he did say something when I profiled him in 2010. The long time.
Before Esperanza Spalding.
He said something to the effect, and I don't think it was a specific lyrical notion, but it was maybe a broader idea about music, that like you have to do something sometimes that's a little bit wrong because it gets people's attention, it pulls people in. If you know, 90, if you're doing 100% of the right thing, you're gonna lose people
too smooth away.
I wish I could remember the specifics. Maybe I'll try to dig up the transcript and find the exact quote, but I remember thinking at the time, what a smart way to think of it, especially in a genre where I think people are increasingly at that era preoccupied with pop and smoothness and so on and so forth. And him saying yes to all that, and also I, as a rapper who sings, a singer who raps, I also have a certain fundamental smoothness in my presentation, but I want to do things that are a little bit like...
You think stand-ups do that? They put like clunky jokes in?
I imagine like it's people? Either clunky jokes or rhythmically. I think probably in stand-up it probably functions rhythmically.
Yeah.
Like ways of talking people through things, then making them stop in a way that in a place that they didn't expect to stop.
Yeah.
And then just when they're feeling unanchored, yanking them back. There are some groaners on this album that I think function that way. And I think when we're talking about Drake, I think there's this sense that he's doing everything with exactly the same valence of seriousness.
Right.
And I do not think that that's the case. You have to take Drake in broader context. You have to understand that he's an astute enough writer, an astute enough thinker, and frankly, an astute enough actor to sometimes be delivering things super straight-faced, sometimes be delivering things with a wink, and frankly, sometimes be delivering things with a shrug or a groan. And I think, like the line about feel like I'm bi, she's like one of the guys. Like, he knows that we're going to talk about that right now. And he knows that people are going to be like, this guy, can you believe it? Like, of all this guy.
You have a historical favorite Drake groaner? Damn. Or just one that comes to mind?
I really wish I would have prepared for that question.
to me, the archetypal Drake groaner is Let the Lights Dim Some. And like, there's a lot of those.
And also that line was early enough in his catalog that I remember there was debate. Like, does he know what he's doing? Does he think he's allowed to say that? You know what I mean? And in retrospect, it's like, obviously he knew what he was doing. Like 100%.
Yeah. All right, but going back to the...
That was rough.
But like,
it did what it was supposed to do.
It stuck.
And again, it's like, you don't have to like agree with it in like an ethical or moral sense, but it is a line of fiction delivered by a character actor making music.
That's what I mean. And I do think, like, just to answer my own question, I think the overwhelming sort of personal aspect of the criticism and the vitriol for Drake at this moment does come from the fact that he built his brand on relatability and authenticity. Like, I think that is a risk that comes with making people feel like they know you and your story is that when they get sick of you, it's like you, it's not your music, it's not your rapping, it's like the man that you are.
But also, do you think that part of it is there's a second layer to it, which is like, because I was trying to take seriously the idea that Drake, as a 36-year-old, there are things that he shouldn't be rapping about. I was trying to take seriously that idea. I don't think that's real, but I was like trying to take seriously that idea.
This is the question of like, should Drake be more mature?
Anyway, I was trying to take seriously that idea. And I was trying to figure out like, who are the people who are most perplexed or concerned by what Drake is rapping about? And if I had to guess, and again, I didn't do like a one for one on all the tweets. I didn't do like a demographic breakdown. But like, if I had to guess, the people who are most concerned are people who have grown up with Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And they are finding themselves maybe evolving in a different way and looking at Drake and saying, he's still kind of on the same stuff. Now, you may think that's bad. That's not bad. That's valid. That's not valid. It could go in either way. But the thing that I was really struck by is like, all right, Drake has been very famous for, let's call it 15 years. So if you were 20 in 2008, your Drake was Drake. If you were 20 in like 2013, your Drake was Drake. If you were 20 in like 2017, your Drake was Drake. And now all those people are aging out, but there is someone who is 20 right now whose Drake is Drake. Am I kicking facts? No, seriously. Like, it doesn't, like, it is not an artist's obligation to grow or evolve in the same pattern as the fans that he, she, or they had at the beginning or middle of their career. There are people who are encountering Drake roughly for the first time now in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, I know it seems unlikely.
Sure.
But there are people who are, this is their entry point into Drake. And why can't Drake make music that serves as this generation's entry point in a way that he made music that served as an earlier generation's entry point?
It's like Blink-182. Their fans, always the same age. You know?
That is rude.
But you know what I mean? It's just like, there's always going to be young people into an artist, especially who is about that move, that swing between adolescent,
mm-hmm,
pettiness and like want, and
that's where that generation, that age group, yeah, lives.
Yes.
So that's why I'm sort of frustrated with the idea of someone being like, if I had to guess, the people who are frustrated, like I said, are people who have, they were there 5 years ago and they were there 8 years ago. And now they're like, I'm not there anymore. And that's okay. You don't have to be there anymore, but you don't have to sort of tisk someone who hasn't walked the same road.
What about musically? Because to me, there's some interesting sounds on this album. I do think if you took 5 or 7 of these beats and flows and melodic and lyrical approaches, and you tried to compare them to something on a Drake album from, say, the first 3 Drake albums, you'd be like, whoa, sounds like a lot of time has passed. Like, he's doing new experiments. He's trying different.
Which has been the case for at least the last 5 years.
It definitely feels like he now has said basically what he needs to say as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the innovation now is like you were saying, like, but is in form, but more subtly than it used to be in terms of disrupting the form. But the fact that he is rapping on all these Benny X beats, he's doing, you know, IDGAF with Yeet, really trying to meet him on those terms. He's doing this Yachty sort of futuristic,
yeah, another late
new,
night
new swag rap style that he did a little bit on Her Loss, and then there's the really aggressive sort of like what I think of as like the meltdown Drake, like from the Travis Scott song from earlier this year, which you get a lot like on First Person Shooter, or the first half of this album when he's rapping and it's like the flows are simpler, but they're like there's like a lot of aggression in both the sound and the delivery.
The flows are simpler and there's a lot of repetition.
Yes.
That is the thing. And if I don't like it as much.
Me either.
It's not my favorite Drake mode.
That mode doesn't work for me.
And also, I don't think it really plays to his strengths. I think if he's amplifying, if he's like puffing his chest when he's doing it, in a way, it's his way. It's his way of displaying that he understands that the mode itself is not terribly well suited to him. I mean, Drake's best modes, emotional, vulnerable, lyrical, if we're going to talk lyrics or flow patterns, we're talking very, very nimble, intricate. You know, Drake is a better technical rapper than people give him credit for. So when he's doing a flow that's like, forgive me, but like kind of a dumb flow, it's like, I think he's sort of like, I'm doing a dumb flow, like just to like let you know that he knows that he's doing a thing that's like maybe not exactly right for him.
And then he'll disrupt it too, like you're saying, like he'll screw it up on purpose or he'll hold back a rhyme or something. Like the last verse on First Person Shooter, I thought it was like the most successful version of him doing this because he's really like landing some body blows, right? He's really like jabbing. But the first half of that song before the beat switch doesn't work for me.
Let's talk about some actually, I think, legitimately good songs. Because I think the big picture musically on this album is even the best songs largely feel like lesser versions of like songs from 2 to 3 years ago. This is not a standout Drake album. There are standout moments. If you look at the Drake innovations of like the late 2010s into Certified Lover Boy, right? He's like, what if I engage with Afrobeats? What if I engage with UK flows? What if I, these kind of like big picture things. And I think on this album, they're more micro.
Yeah, the tweaks are smaller.
And it's not that they're not effective, but they don't feel committed. Like we could talk about Calling For You, which has a Cash Cobain beat.
Yeah, which is sexy. Drake doing sexy drill.
Yeah, which is, again, fine, but he doesn't fully commit to it. And I actually bet if there's like a Lucy of Drake doing sexy drill, that's just going to come out like 4 weeks from now.
Yeah.
That's going to be way better if I had to guess. What else? Oh, we haven't talked about Rich Baby Daddy.
So that might be...
Great. That's, I think, the best song on the record.
Yeah, I mean...
But should we listen to it?
Yeah, let's listen to a little bit of Rich Baby Daddy with SZA and Sexy Rack.
Sexy Rack. Don't hear me put a rack on me. We from two different worlds, but it's a match to me. To bend it over, only time she turn her back on me for real. Bend that ass over. Let that coochie breathe. Shake that ass, bitch. Hands on your knees. Hands on your knees. Hands on your knees. Shake that ass for Drake.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Also just a gift of A&Ring.
And Drake doing Florence and the Machine in the outro?
Really on that 2007 swag. Is he going to break out the Peter Bjorken job?
Yeah, going back. When he says the old Drake, he means interpolating indie rock hits.
So he does that, and he does that with Pet Shop Boys too, which is not an indie rock hit. But anyway, yes, that is what he means. Girl, don't tempt me. I'm going to go back and go to the indie playlist on Spotify, I guess.
When you have as many albums as Drake and as many hits as Drake, to me, a lot of what you're doing at this point in your career can be measured not by like, is this a great body of work top to bottom? Because like, okay, 23 song album, we're already excusing that as a possibility. So to me, it's like, are any of these songs making the greatest hits, the two disc greatest hits? Are any of these songs making the playlist? Are any of these songs making the set list at my arena show, fitting in between?
Okay.
20 of my biggest hits, especially after this is no longer the new album. Like, okay. Do any of these songs stick around?
I have a slightly different read on this, but yes, continue this thought. But I was thinking something similar with a different artist.
And on those terms, I think this album fails.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think a lot of these make the top tier of all-time Drake songs, which again is only a testament to how much good music he has, because for a lot of artists, these would be in their top tier. But that's where I can see some fatigue. And I think he didn't do himself any favors by what was once making this album seem like it was going to be tossed off in the same way that Honestly Nevermind and Her Loss were, yeah, which felt like sort of minor stopgap experimental works.
I vastly prefer.
Which, right. And I think that when he first mentioned this album with the poetry book in June, mm-hmm, that it felt like it was going to be another one of those. And maybe it would only have 10 or 14 songs on, mm-hmm, it. The fact that he then spent all summer tweaking on it, like, reminds me of, like, you're working on a piece and you're like, no. Like, I just got to add one more line. Like, I just had to add one more graph. Oh, here's this other detail I forgot. And then it just bloats and bloats and bloats. And then you've been talking about it for so long that, yep, it feels like it's supposed to be a masterwork and meaningful, as opposed to just a collection of fun summer songs. Like, I think the marketing of this album really did it no favors.
I agree with that. I had an interesting thought. Okay, so totally unrelated. I don't know if you saw, like, Paramore announced that they had
a remix album.
Yeah, and they had a song with Talking Heads on there.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Or David Byrne.
Yeah, forget. Sure.
And I was like, what's the utility of, like, a Paramore Talking Heads song in 2023? And I realized that, like, for certain bands, obviously Paramore's career different from Drake's career, but, like,
oh really?
But you could say that, like, Paramore has their suite of familiar gestures that they return to on late period albums.
Wish they'd returned to power chords.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not saying that they successfully returned or they pick all the right ones, but There is a Paramore soundboard that they return to. Drake, obviously a Drake soundboard that he returns to. But I was thinking, like, what's the purpose of a song like that? And it's like, I don't think it's to improve the Paramore catalog. If anything, I think for a group like that, it's to give them a reason to go out and replay essentially old stuff, to feel okay about the foundation by saying, hey, at least it earned us the right to do this. And I think for Paramore, doing this is working with a legendary group. For Drake, doing this is like working with Sexy Red.
Right. Or Chief Keef.
Right.
But who gets like 3.5 bars.
Yeah, 3.5 bars and then sampled on another song. Probably making more publicity than most producers on this record.
I do think that was a nice little gift from Drake. He was like, all right, I'm not going to use your second verse, which then Chief Keef just put on his Instagram story, which, like, again, we've all put outtakes on our Instagram story. But he's like, all right, if I'm not going to use most of what you sent me, I'll at least sample you on another song so you can get the real money.
Damn, I don't like what you did on them trips. You did to your lips. I don't like you telling just one side. I don't like the fact you never cry. Blame that shit on being 25. That excuse for me just doesn't fly. Zach keeps saying me that 7'9. That shit just gonna hang you on my.
So when I was listening to this album and I was thinking, like, 2/3 of these songs are lesser versions of older Drake songs. But if those are the songs that get you to Rich Baby Daddy, if those are the songs that get you to, I mean, even like, frankly, oh, I mean, Members Only.
Yep.
A great
big record. Return for Party Next Door.
We should listen to Members Only.
Yep. Melodically, probably the most interesting song thing going on here.
Green flag and a white flag to surrender. My ex-girl was a head case. I cannot defend her. You're too down with the gang. You're one of my members. They see it coming around in a realest way. Now the most getting friendlier. You're too down with the.
And also, like, there is a very, very classic old Drake, like true old Drake song, Just Tried Our Best. The first words I typed out when I was taking notes on Trying Our Best was La Raji ass beat.
It's true.
Did you see the videos of La Raji performing in, like, a farm this weekend?
No.
some festival on a farm for cows. I mean, I assume there were people there too, but anyway, all I saw the video.
The cows were loving it.
The cows were vibing. Anyway, this is a Lil Raji ass beat. And it's also like truly classic old Drake. And I think for me, as someone that's been listening for 15 years, there is something fundamentally reassuring that this person, no longer an outsider, the consummate insider, no longer an Aravist, like absolutely the top of the food chain, still can access this like very raw, dark, vulnerable thing within and make a very convincing song about it. Very smooth.
Let's go out on a little bit of that.
Absolutely.
We all tried our best.
I swear that there's a list of places that I've been with you. I wanna go without you, just so I can know what it's like to be there without having to argue. I swear I didn't have the discipline to leave your ass at home. You make it hard to. This life would take a lot of listening to one another. Shouldn't have involved you. I know not to now leave you at home if I wanna have a good night.
You think Drake's gonna be the Golden Bachelor one day?
Wow. the Golden Retriever Bachelor.
I need the AI aged Drake as Golden Bachelor.
Right. As opposed to the reverse aging high school photos that everybody's been posting. We got to do Golden Bachelor AI.
Yeah.
All right. Someone get on that. Whoever did the Steve Harvey thing should get on that as well. Okay. There's a lot going on in reality television. So we are going to talk about Golden Bachelor. We are going to talk about Survivor. I kind of want to start by talking about Love is Blind.
Welcome to Love is Blind.
What's up, what's up?
I could be finding my wife here.
When are you going to propose to me?
My heart's pounding, but it's not in a bad way. Did you just burp?
Okay, so I've been watching all the seasons of Love is Blind. I will say, on television, this one takes place in Houston. On television, this is by far the lamest season. The couples who have made it, we are now, I think as of now, we are every episode but the wedding or non-wedding episode. Like the last episode is like, they go to the altar, but do they get married?
You like when the Netflix shows come out week to week?
As opposed to in one big batch?
Yeah.
I don't mind it. I don't like.
Which is it? Are we TV or are we not TV?
You mean like they should do like one episode a week as opposed to three a week?
Or, no, I'm like, just like.
Or just drop
just
all.
Put, like if you're not on my television, just
well, I
give
will
me
say like
shows.
The stretched out timeline has actually really played well with what's happening off camera.
All right, keep
here.
Going then.
Okay, so like many years ago, I wrote about in the LA Times how the Kardashians were like incredibly good in early Kardashian era of understanding how the timing of the rollout of the show was coincident with the timing of gossip in real life in the tabloid era.
Yeah.
And how they did a really, really good job of having two things running simultaneously that in real life happened 4 months apart, 8 months apart. But when everything came out, there was some kind of implicit discourse between what's happening on the screen and what's happening IRL. That's totally normalized now. And especially in the era of every former reality star has a podcast. Everyone has a TikTok and an Instagram. You're getting a lot of tea that you wouldn't ordinarily
get. And you
get
multiple waves of the same topic.
Constantly. You're getting people anticipating the drop of episodes. Then you're getting people reacting to the drop of episodes. And then you're getting the fallout from how those episodes have been structured. So Love is Blind on camera. Terrible season. Really like unpleasant. A lot of mean girling, a lot of like subpar couples who kind of like really feel like they're grappling with the basics of what it means to love somebody.
Aren't they all in their distinct pods or it's not like that anymore? I can't stomach this show.
Okay, so they start in the pods, then they agree to be married, then they meet, and then they go on a honeymoon for, well, not a honeymoon, like a vacation for a week. Then they live together for like a month, and then they decide.
Once they exit the pods.
Yeah.
So love is not, in fact, blind.
No, because the number of these couples don't, some couples maybe don't make it to the altar, and when the ones that do, some don't get married.
But I mean, they see each other long before they get married.
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
And so, but I'm watching the show and I'm just like, oh, this is really annoying. Like, I'm kind of maybe giving up halfway through. It's like not that exciting. what is happening offline is outlandish. If you are following Love is Blind TikTok, so apparently there are entire arcs of couples that fell in love in the pods and made it to the altar that were cut from the show entirely.
Some of whom are now suing the show.
Some are suing the show. There are allegations of abuse and other things. There's at least two couples, I believe, whose entire love story was 100% excised from this season.
Left on the cutting room floor.
Presumably to decrease liability. And apparently there's something with the contracts. You know, there. I was watching some TikTok that sort of suggested that bachelor contracts are so airtight that you can't say anything that potentially goes against the production company, the production itself, other contestants, so on and so forth, whatever. But seemingly the contracts that are governing Love is Blind contestants is much looser. And if so, wisely so, because what it's doing is creating an entire narrative cycle that has nothing to do with what's on camera. And if anything, what's on camera is purposefully dry, perhaps as a tool of triggering an intense amount of conversation off camera, online, driving people eventually back to the show itself.
Are you galaxy braining and saying that this is all?
I am galaxy braining.
All organized?
I am galaxy braining. I also, I said at the beginning, I wanted to talk about what are the responsibilities of producers here. And I think in all the shows we're going to talk about, I've had questions this year of what do you know and what don't you know? And what do you say you know? And what are you hiding? One of the main trigger points in this season of Love is Blind is that two of the characters, Uche on the men's side and Lydia on the women's side, had a relationship prior to the show. It's hard to tell how involved that relationship was. I think if you kind of read it, it's an intermittent relationship that went on for some time.
Okay.
But ended a couple months before the show taped.
And then they're put together or they're put separate?
Well, they're she's on the women's side and he's on the men's side. Now, what ends up happening is they have their first blind date, realize that it's each other, and then they commit and they say, you know what? We're in this process to meet a new person. We're not going to see each other, quote unquote. We're not
going to they commit to being broken up.
Yes. But what happens is then he falls for someone else and she befriends that woman in like a really uncomfortable way, like so uncomfortable. And shout out the producers for doing this. It was so uncomfortable that I remember watching it in like episode two or episode three and being like, this is, they hadn't said what had happened yet. And I was like, this is extremely strange the way that Lydia is talking to Aaliyah. She literally says to Aaliyah, I'm just like you. I'm just like you. I'm just like you. We're the same. We're the same. And Aaliyah's like, cool. What are you talking about? But okay, but thank you. But also, what are you talking about? Anyway, it's extremely disturbing. And I was wondering, now, in interviews, the producer or executive producer of the show has said, hey, we didn't know. We didn't know that Uche and Lydia were involved. Well, of course, that's my reaction to it. And it's like, that can't be right.
Eyebrow.
Also, is not part of the application process for the show. I mean, forgive me, but like, I've never applied for one of these shows, but I've got to assume, is the application process putting a list down of like, here's the people I've been involved with?
We've seen this on The Bachelor too. They've had Bachelor contestants that have some history with either the contestant themselves or that two of the women have dated the same man or something. Like, they've thrown these variables in there a couple times.
There's no way in my mind.
No, it's all intentional, of course.
And so for the producers to like go out into the world and be like, we didn't know, that seems wrong to me. It seems implausible and also wrong. But let's say they're being sincere. Do you not have some kind of ethical responsibility? I mean, again, these are reality television producers.
Yeah.
But do you not have some kind of ethical
producers? It's like a Drake album, you know? It's just all evil all the time.
Seeing what happened on this season of Love and Blind got me thinking about what do producers, what are they obligated to do? What are they not obligated to do? And I had a very, so anyway, Love is Blind, if you're watching the show, it's mid. If you're on TikTok, it's absolutely on fire.
But this is almost all
all TV.
TV.
All, at this
and point. Especially all reality TV, which is like it's as much about the extracurricular as it is about what's like. Absolutely. This is the thing with Vanderpump. This is the thing with Below Deck. It's the thing with Survivor. It's like it's all, it's 360, right? It's mm-hmm. not just
no,
it's, what it's, you sit down and watch. It's the accounts you're on. Who's following who? Who's unfollowing who?
Yes.
Who's paparazzied out with so-and-so? Mm-hmm. Which is actually just a teaser for next week's episode. Like, it's exactly. like this, like you're saying, this three-dimensional chess game that really the Kardashians were the first and best at is now...
It's the total...
The default of
right.
the medium.
I had a similar feeling about producer ethics on the first episode of the current season of Survivor. And you know why. Because they literally almost killed that poor man, Brandon. They almost killed him.
I know.
And
he was an incredible character.
Survivor's been my favorite thing in the world for 15 years.
I've watched it more than you can even believe that I've watched it.
Like, I've studied this. I know everything that everybody's done in every season.
Okay, so if you don't watch Survivor, to me, the primary problem with Survivor right now is almost everybody is a super fan. Everybody has studied the game. Everybody's watched the show for 1, 3, 5, 10, 12 years. Almost everyone's narrative is that going on Survivor will heal them.
Right.
It will somehow make pure this thing that's broken inside them. Now, unfortunately for Brandon, he is quite literally
cut out for him.
Like, unfortunately, like his entire physical, I mean, we, you know, we're not here to comment on people's physical selves, but this is not a fit person. This is not like a physically fit person. And I'm not
those
saying
people
that
have succeeded on Survivor before.
They have, but there is something where he just does not seem up to the task.
Yes.
Quite literally. And has to essentially be medically treated after it's not even the first challenge, right? I mean, was that the first challenge? It was the first challenge.
Yeah.
So he has to be medically treated and then has anxiety attacks. And frankly, it was extremely concerning. It was probably as concerning a moment on Survivor as like any of the medical interventions.
Right. But when you think back, it's like people who are not physically fit thrive at Survivor all the time. Like, if you think of two of the greatest survivors of all time, like Sandra and Sari, mm-hmm. those are people who are like, I'm not even going to try in the challenges. Right.
But that's like part of their thing.
Yeah.
Right.
It's because they're so psychologically sharp and astute and good at the game. But here's the thing, even beyond people being super fans, it's not just that they're super fans. Like, let's just say it. It's that they're nerds on top of being super fans. There's a really good tweet about this, about how there's too many former gifted kids on Survivor now. Like, mm-hmm. we need some regular ass hotties. Like, we need some basic people.
We need some Big Brother contestants.
Yeah, like, and they're used to the mix. You know, Survivor always used to start as like the jocks versus like the outcasts.
Yes.
And the cool kid clique would always get dismantled. And that was like one of the joys of watching a season of Survivor, is almost every time the people who were the
kind of like nerd Survivor player became archetypical.
That was always an archetype, like a little subsection is now the whole show.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought like the Brandon plotline paired with the Emily plotline. So Emily is the character that they, speaking of producer intervention, they started by only making her look like she had the worst personality of all time. And then they've slowly built her back up to be winning in some way and like an underdog.
Yes.
And
we'll
see how
that actually plays.
Yeah. And I thought they were doing the same thing with Brandon. And I thought those were going to be the main characters, basically, that were going to carry us throughout the season.
He just wanted him dead.
But Brandon was so bad at Survivor that they, like, even the producers couldn't save him.
But this is what I'm saying. So you say that there are players who were not physically up to the Survivor tasks. And it's like, you know, think about Jam Jam or somebody.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, really came into his own.
Of course.
I've got to assume that there's a battery of tests that potential Survivor players are subjected to. And again, I can only speculate how Brandon performed on tests like that. But is there not some producer obligation?
Some like baseline.
Yeah, to say like this person is not physically equipped and this person is not emotionally equipped.
I would say it's more of the latter.
I, I mean, it was shocking that the other woman, what was her name, who left, who like self-ejected.
Oh, the one who was like, I need my jewel pods. Like, that was the, Hannah. Yeah, who volunteered herself to be the first person eliminated because she just wanted to smoke.
And literally every person on the tribe, including Brandon, was like, I'm pretty sure Brandon should go. Like, literally pretty sure Brandon. And she was like, absolutely not. Like, I will walk out.
Watching Brandon essentially have a panic attack, it was like a shock to the system. And so I am feeling entirely overwhelmed. What did I get myself into?
I just watched that and I understand that we are 25 years into reality television. To even ask questions like this feels silly and naive. And like, I understand how these things work, but I was watching that and I was like, you are literally rinsing this poor kid for what?
Whose whole dream was to be on Survivor.
Literally, his whole dream wasn't to be medevaced off Survivor. It was to play Survivor. And are you telling me in good faith that not one person in the production cycle, in the decision-making part,
before, was like, maybe this guy can't.
Yeah, like
it.
Maybe like, let's say, hey, we like you, but maybe come back in a year, maybe like bulk up, like something. I just feel like someone has to be like,
take a breath. Yeah. come back. You're waitlisted.
I mean, yeah, literally, truly. I mean, I also have this anxiety. You haven't watched Golden Bachelor.
Well, that was my next question. Top line thoughts on Golden Bachelor. Maybe we'll return to it later in the season.
I have this like persistent anxiety in the second half of these episodes.
It sounds like you chose me.
This just doesn't work out.
I can't keep going like this.
I just don't have the connection that I did.
I'm sorry.
Oh my God, how is this happening?
Oh boy, gonna hit the fan now.
The only time I've ever felt worse in my whole life is when my wife passed away.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Shout out Gary.
He's killing it.
I mean, what, just like, he's pure, he's got great, he's looking great, you know what I mean?
Like, does look great.
It's like, on the one hand, he's like, can you imagine the good fortune, like me, a widower from Indiana, here in Gora Hills with 20 beautiful women, you know, 20 beautiful age-appropriate women. But then there's like the tiny bit of a spark where he's like,
sly.
He knows what he's got. He says at some point his daughter told him he has Riz.
I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Gary's a great character, but there's something about like the intensity of the potential splits that they are foreshadowing,
right,
which seem apocalyptic.
Yeah, like the pressure cooker of The Bachelor is really hard on a heart that's lived a life.
It causes me some stress. There's literally
a lot of anxiety for a guy who watches a lot of anxiety making TV.
I do.
Yeah.
I have a lot of anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. You're vulnerable to other people's experience on screen. And yet absolutely, you pick a lot of stressful television.
I also watch a lot of HGTV.
Yeah. I guess that's how you balance it out. But between the reality stuff, which I is very fragile.
Because I think what I find myself gravitating towards in a reality context is, there are very few pure emotions left to be kind of like squeezed on reality TV. It's why I don't watch the Bachelor ecosystem generally anymore.
Yeah.
All those gestures played out.
Yeah.
That's why I don't watch Big Brother anymore, because those gestures are played out. Like, a lot of things I felt very committed to very early in their arcs, I felt like I saw almost. I don't watch the Kardashians anymore. Like, anytime I see the
hint, Hulu Kardashians is hard.
What's that?
Hulu Kardashians is hard.
Is it?
You should tap back in.
Okay. Yeah. Noted. But I feel like anytime I see a flicker of like a genuine emotion, That's what I was there for. That's why I was writing about it 20 years ago. That's why I cared about it. So I'm trying to seek that out, like chase that high over and over and over again. And watching Golden Bachelor, even though it causes anxiety.
It's bringing that old Drake feeling back.
It absolutely is. I can't think of a more Drake-like reality show than Golden Bachelor.
All right, I'm going to catch up on it and maybe we'll circle back to it before the end of the season.
Okay. We have a viewer question. I don't find this to be a Drake-like phenomenon, but I bet there are some people who complain about Drake who would find this to be a Drake-like phenomenon. Should we get into it?
Yeah.
This question's from Maddie Joyner. There's a lot of premises that you have to accept in order to take this question at face value. But we'll do that and then we'll unpack. Maddie says, what are your guys' thoughts on the demonic strain throughout popular music? Is the quote, I sold my soul to the devil and that's where all this talent came from? Shout out Robert Johnson.
Yep. Crossroad Blues.
Big boy. Is that narrative pushing it? Is it just a convenient heuristic image or mode an artist assumes for the sake of a song / project / PR stunt? Does it appear regionally in some genres? Is there entirely something else that I'm missing? The diabolical lyric. That doesn't sound like a Wu-Tang lyric from 95. The diabolical lyric, sonic, aesthetic, and visual references are so common and honestly hackneyed that I never stopped to consider how strange it could seem until a friend asked me what I make of all the references to demons in pop music right now. Have you had a friend ask you about
the demons? I thought demons. Just Maddie.
Yeah, just Maddie. Obviously, Lil Nas X has become a champion of the trope. But so many others at the forefront of the industry are tapping into it as well. Drake's new album cover?
I do think that goat is quite demonic. And I do think it was important that Adonis told us that
it's a child.
But he said it's a goat. It's daddy goat. It's not a dog, even though the album is called For All the Dogs.
Daddy's name is next to the goat. Does that mean that daddy's the goat?
Yes. So it's daddy goat.
Daddy goat.
The red eyes, I mean, it's like it's giving the witch, you know?
Black Philip Sif, you are wicked.
Does he really speak to thee?
You don't. You've never seen The Witch.
Both you and you are bugging, just for the record. Doja Cat's lead singles for Scarlet. Billie Eilish's When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know?
Yeah, scary. Scary album.
Scary album. I mean, Billie Eilish live show. Scary.
Yeah.
Scary. Beyonce's Sasha Fierce persona?
I don't know. Can't go there.
I'm going to bat. No, that's a no for me. And that feels like it's barely scratching the surface. What do you guys make of it all? Thank you for your time. Y'all are awesome. Well, no demons here.
No.
No, nothing demonic about Bobcast Deluxe.
Only pure energy.
Angel baby energy.
I think it's tongue in cheek. I think it's so hackneyed.
It's in pure trope.
That it's, yeah, I think it's like, you know, we've been through so many cycles now of Illuminati accusations. You remember when Offset and Lil Uzi Vert got into it over like upside down crosses?
Yeah. Stop that shit, boy. You look lame. All that worship the devil shit. Deal with God, man.
And like,
I was going to say Uzi is an interesting.
Yeah. Playboy Cardi, like all the way back through.
Is opium demonic?
All the way back through Raider Clan.
You know what's demonic is making me listen to a full album by an opium artist. It's not Playboy Cardi.
Yeah.
That's demonic.
Back through to 666 Mafia.
Of course.
All the way to Robert Johnson in the 30s. It's just sitting right there. And I actually think that Lil Nas X's Satan stuff, he gets to do it because some people really do think he's Satan. But I mean, I'm tired of all of it. I actually thought Doja pulled it off mostly. And I think that in her whole war with her fans about whether or not she is demonic, like, it's funny for her to do it.
Also, like, demonic as I almost think it's diminishing what actual demonic behavior is. Mm-hmm. Like, the things that Doja Cat
actual
is
doing, demonic behavior, everything that Drake has ever done or said.
Said Twitter. Like, if we're going to talk about demonic behavior, use it in the purest sense of the word. Don't abstract it to be like, it's about Satan.
It's about horns.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't think, is it weird to say I don't think Satan is real?
I mean, hot take for the pod. But.
I mean, I guess I don't want to get emails
you
about
don't,
that.
You don't think he's like a red guy with a tail? Or you don't think evil exists?
That's a crazy philosophical question. Pretty sure evil exists. Don't think it's a red guy with a tail. Just throwing that out there. Don't think so. Okay, but I do want to take, I do, despite the fact that I don't believe that Satan is a red guy with a tail, I do want to take part of the premise of this question very seriously. Doja Cat is playing with the trope, but also doing things that I think could be construed as morally troubling.
Right.
The Billie Eilish question is actually quite interesting to me, because Billie Eilish plays with horror and spooky imagery in a way that feels not, it's theatrical.
It's more
but it's not. Yeah, it's theatrical, but artful. Correct. It's not theatrical and exaggerated. It's theatrical and artful. And I wonder, like, I remember going to the, obviously not the first Billie Eilish concert, but I remember being legitimately like, this is unusual. And also, it's a bunch of 14-year-old girls here.
Yeah, the 14-year-old girls.
Loving it.
Spookiest of all.
Yeah, no, they're loving it. That to me, if there's like, and again, demonic, and this is not a real thing, but like, let's take it seriously. That to me is a striking aesthetic choice worthy of discussion. Lil Nas X, you often bleed.
Giving a lap dance to Satan.
He's just fucking with y'all. That's just it. He's fucking with y'all. Sorry. And that's okay. Like, I don't think being with is demonic. I don't.
What about the blood and the Nikes?
That's just bad taste. Would not cop.
Just troll.
Truly would not cop.
Right. So the distinction you're making is troll.
You know what's demonic? Make a blood-filled sneaker I would wear.
I don't think we're at a particularly high moment of it outside of Doja Cat, who maybe took it from Lil Nas X. But I'm willing to go a little darker. I want to see who can actually push a button. I'm ready.
Someone in the Illuminati would say that.
Exactly. You have any happy music for us to listen to?
No, but I do have a song. So we didn't really talk about Jelly Roll.
Mm.
I find Jelly Roll fascinating as a character. I didn't really love the album. I think it's overly simplifies the thing that I think is good about him or could be good about him. But Jelly Roll appears as like the rap feature, getting back to rapping, which I respect, on a song called Wild Ones by Jesse Murph, who is sort of like a kind of like nasally voiced country pop singer, like did a record with Diplo and Polo G. You seem
which
like,
is a sentence I'd never thought I'd hear.
Yeah, like it's she kind of sounds like Morgan Wade covering Bailey Bryan.
Wow.
Yeah. If you're not up on Bailey Bryan, like get involved in that first EP. Some of the later stuff's a little too pop leaning for my taste, but like the first EP when she was still kind of like puzzling through the space between pop and country, that stuff was really good. So anyway, this is kind of in that vein a tiny bit, much more like Southern, has like a heavier regionality to it. But Jelly Roll, he gets on here and he's spitting. Talk about demonic. This, you know what's demonic? This flow.
Answer me how I've been feeling lately. Coming for mine, then this do or die. I won't let it slide. No stealing bases, no back and forth bargaining. No bitching and arguing.
Do you have something more healing for us?
Yeah, we're going to go out with good vibes. Rami from the XX.
Sure.
She put out a solo album last month.
I've heard.
It's called Midair. We didn't talk about it. A lot of production from Fred again. Some Stuart Price on there. The last track, She's On My Mind, really beautiful. I think, you know, when you think of the XX, it's all tension and no release. And this album is taken from 90s trance and house with a real pop touch. And it's all about spiritual fulfillment and personal fulfillment, love, drugs, friends. Just really, really beautiful vibes.
Know what time it is?
Snack time.
It is snack time. I find myself, I don't know if it's Pavlovian at this point, but I do find that every episode, at the moment when we are done with songs, I immediately have a pang of hunger right here. I can feel it. And maybe it's just because I know, maybe I'm just like a dog where I was like, I know the treat's coming. I know it's coming. But I just like, I feel like a very specific, intense craving for a snack right now.
I don't know if you're going to consider this a treat. But this is our very first upscale snack on Popcast Deluxe.
Okay, that's fine. Upscale, rich folk can get down.
Every week we eat a snack.
We do.
We usually trend toward novelty junk.
Sure.
But we got a special delivery from a listener, viewer, Popcast Deluxe fan, e-fan.
Yeah.
Shout out to you. Thank you so much. Who delivered us the 11 Madison Park Nori Bar Nuts. These are Japanese peanut, spiced cashew, and smokehouse almond from the plant-based fine dining establishment 11 Madison
Park. That is also partnered with Styles P. Had something. I swear I'm not making this up. Styles PB&J, available through 11 Madison Home, the restaurant shop selling plant-based pantry staples and kitchen essentials.
This is from 11 Madison Home.
Wow.
You think Styles P likes these nuts?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to just do a handful here so we make sure to mix it up.
So it's three different kinds.
Three different kinds. Oh my gosh.
Are they in a cluster?
Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, these cashews look a little bit like a gem, you know, or like a shell that
something
you
like the Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, like, yeah. And like a constellation of colors. It's yeah, really
they're coated in something that is also adhesive, so it's there's multiple pieces stuck together.
There's a lot going on here visually.
Woo!
Cashew tastes like the ocean in a classy way. This makes me want to go for a Michelin starred meal.
Yeah. Wow.
This is not a Little Debbie, put it that way. We're not good enough for these. We're not good enough for these. These are.
Why would you talk down about yourself?
I just think that these belong in the hands of somebody who can truly appreciate them.
They are.
You're welcome.
I'm going to say I think the peanut is the purest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Japanese peanut. Great crunch.
Incredible crunch. It's like somehow that trick of it's a peanut, but it's not. I mean, it is, but.
I mean, look at those crystals.
Yeah, whatever that is, A plus.
Yeah.
The almond to me, I'm a little bit off on like almonds in general as like a standalone snack. Also, this will not surprise you. I do find it a little spicy. Incredible. This is an 8.5.
Yeah.
I mean, taken all together.
It's good stuff.
I would have this in the house.
Yeah.
And I would make somebody else eat the almonds.
You would leave the almonds behind. I think actually the cashews would be first to go. Mm-hmm. Just because they're
most
grabby.
Yeah. The most complex, most visually interesting.
This is good stuff though. I give it an 8 out of 10. I could use a little more spice. Sorry.
Jeez. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. get in the Facebook group, in the Discord. That's tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook or podcast Discord. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That's Apple or Spotify or YouTube, where you also can see all episodes of Podcast Deluxe, including our missing third person, our partner, Maren Morris, who was here last week. tinyurl.com/podcast deluxe. You can get all those episodes. Our senior producer is Sawyer Roque. Our editor is Jamie Heffitz. Thank you to Nell Galogli, Karen Gans, Pat Gunther, Leslie Davis,
Pedro Rosado.
We will be back next week.